This is Brent, Warhammer Fantasy fanboy. I won't screw up. I never screw up.
Just making sure. Last time we had a problem.
No, that's because last time you were drinking. Oh, you're drinking again.
A little bit.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm Jerry.
And I'm John.
And I'm Jason, the creator of the Army Showcase. And tonight we're going to continue our discussion of Warhammer.
You can do it twice, remember.
I can do it twice. Three times I like to. Yeah. We're continuing our discussion of Warhammer Fantasy 8th Edition on this episode of the Tabletop Battlefield. Welcome back to Season 4, Episode 16 of the Tabletop Battlefield, the official podcast of the Army Showcase over at tabletopbattlefield.com. And last time we started our discussion about the new Warhammer Fantasy, which of course is Games Workshop's, Fantasy Battle game, which that's kind of what it's called. It's one of the two main products, of course 40K being the other one. And for some reason I thought we could get through the whole rule discussion in one show, which obviously we couldn't. We got through about one phase of the game. But at least this time we've added John and Jerry to get their opinions to see what they have to say about it. So kind of a recap of last time. We first talked about the book itself, and basically our general, consensus was it's awesome. And it's got about everything a new player needs in there, but you don't necessarily want to show it right to a new player right off the bat because it's kind of big and could be scary. But once they played a few games, it's a great introduction to it.
It could be big and scary.
Yes.
To a new person.
That is kind of
just... Choose slowly. Take
Yes. So let's move on to get John and Jerry's opinions on some of the things we talked about last time, just briefly. The first change we talked about was the new army build rules, where you have percentages instead of slots. What do you guys think about that?
You want to begin?
I will. It's probably the only thing I don't like about it, because it requires me to do way too much math in developing an army list.
And also,
to me, it's a throwback to the 5th edition. I don't remember if 4th edition did percentages, but... 5th edition and 4th edition did percentages, and even though 8th edition doesn't break it, to me, having lived through those two eras of pain, it kind of brings back some of that pain to me. So I don't like it, because now it's not as simple as me, okay, I can only have two choices, and it equals that points, and I'm done. I now have to figure out, okay, 25% of that is 2,000, and 25% is what? Okay, it's not simple math.
Yeah. John?
You know, I gotta disagree with you 100%, but a lot of the a lot of the reasoning behind that is I didn't go through, 4th and 5th and 6th edition, however many decades, I don't know how long you've been going through.
Well, it was when you were in diapers.
Yeah, obviously, yeah, that would actually track. For me, the percentages-based army system... it really gives me a lot of the versatility and flexibility in my list creation that I can explore a lot of things that I normally wouldn't have been able to. Like in the Empire list, actually being able to use Master Engineers, whereas before that was a massive sacrifice because you're missing out on Warrior Priests and such. With the Skaven, I can take those Warlock Engineers and throw them in wherever the heck they need to go. I really appreciate it. I think that it limits your army a lot less than the old hard number system.
Sure, and I have to say that maybe now, as the army books and the game itself has matured more, the percentage system fits better. Because before it was, the rules now, and obviously the army books don't even support it, but you're not knowing 5th or 4th edition, it was an area of abuse, like that. Because you could have 25% of your points go into one massive hero and the rest of the army was just there.
Mm-hmm.
So the one hero could be like a 700-point guy and demolish the enemy's army. Because also the game, if you lost your general, your army took just the way with Tomb Kings are and Vampire Counts. Lose a general, everybody takes a moral check every turn.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a crumble factor to everybody's army.
Now on that topic, Brent said that the 8th edition army building with percentages, while it's kind of a throwback to old editions, it kind of fixes some of the problems that were in 5th and 4th edition.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's
what I'm talking about. Okay. It's because, the game is mature to get better, and two, the army books don't even support. They're night and day now, but still, to me, it's not a lot of math involved to build a list now.
Okay. The next kind of new thing we talked about was terrain. Obviously, there's a lot more of it in 8th edition in the battlefield, and it's going to interact with your characters a lot more in a lot of different ways. What do you guys think about that?
Oh,
Jerry, you want to go first?
Yeah, awesome. I thought that was far too many fantasy games were played on pool tables.
Yes.
Way too many. So, and then the standard tactic is, hey, diddle, diddle, right up the middle. But so now you can actually put terrain in, it actually means something, and then couple that with the fact that there's pre-measurement involved, you aren't spending five turns just trying to maneuver, guessing where you're going. You can actually factor that in chess and say, okay, I can't actually go around this building, or I can, and I think it's great. I think it's a good thing. Now, I think there's a point.
Do you think that there's a point where it becomes overpowering?
There's always a factor where there's too much. Mm-hmm. But that's in 40K as well, and that's between the two players. I mean, if you're, like we were just talking a while ago, we want to do a fantasy game in a city. Well, that's fine, but if you're going to throw down with somebody, probably not the best route. I think if you're going to overdo the terrain, it's got to be an agreement based on what you're going to play, like everything else. But I don't see it that every time I walk to the table, I'm like, oh, that's way too much.
Mm. Now, what about the specific kinds of scenery that are out there, arcane portals and all the things that bring in the special worlds into it? I, for one, am a big fan of it. However, in mass doses, if you roll a lot on that chart and you end up with, 10 different things out there doing 10 different things, how does that play in?
Well, and to preface this a little bit, and Brent, chime in and listen, because I kind of know we've had this discussion. There's a local group here called the Great Heritage Stormhammer League, and they have that rule built into the league but it's a mission-based thing. And the one that sticks out in my head is they have the sheep-based mission where herds of sheep roam the battlefield. And they play equal part in the game where they all of a sudden become impassable terrain that randomly move in front of you. So, and this is where I'm going with this analogy. It can very quickly happen where if the players aren't into that aspect of the 8th edition game rule set, that they will want to ignore it because it becomes a distracting factor to the game. I like it because it adds an unknown certainty to it. It kind of brings that quirkiness of what the Games Workshop hobbies were all about. This, like, orcs spitting off into the air off from rocket jets, and if your model fell off the vehicle, it died. That kind of thing. That quirkiness is back a little bit. But your opponent has to be in on that game as well. Otherwise, you're just going to say, all right, we've got way too many of these. Let's not even play them. Or you forget about them, and at the end of the game, you're like, well, what the hell is this all about anyways?
Got it. Yeah.
Now, quick question for you guys. Have either of you played a game where you had 10 pieces of terrain on the table yet? Because that's the maximum you can possibly get by doing the random D6 plus 4 roll.
I think the most I've had is 8.
I think so. That night we were up here, I think that's 8's been the max.
Okay, did you find that too crowded, or was that...
No.
No, it's pretty good?
No, it was a riot.
What size of the game were you guys playing? 2,000-ish?
Was it 2,000?
I think we were like 1,500 points.
Okay. It wasn't big. We were just trying to play.
Okay.
But we still had units that were like 10 wide maneuvering around there. And it wasn't a problem. And that's on a standard 4x6 table, not even a bigger one.
True. And that's where I get back to the pre-measurement. Because if there was no pre-measurement, you wouldn't have dreamed trying to do it.
Okay.
Because you couldn't judge. Mm-hmm.
And making enemies flee into hostile terrain is pretty funny.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Yes. Brent, hold your microphone up.
Yes, that's awesome.
Yes, that's awesome. Waited. All right. That's something you cut out. Okay. The other big change that was talked about before the rules came out was combat is going to be faster. Now we know that's because there's a lot more attacks and a lot more stuff dies and a lot more stuff can get fight because of all that thing. What do you guys think about that, the more violent close combat? Like it or whatnot?
I'm a big fan of it. I think that the troops, in addition to there being a lot more attacks out there, it's also that they're less survivable. Because you're not getting the extra additional plus one for the hand weapon shield, you don't have as many base infantry floating around out there, two of armor's each and such. So it's the combination of the two things together, and it definitely makes for probably faster games. I don't know, I would say.
I don't think necessarily faster, because the rules also encourage bigger units and smaller point games. Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't see people trying to min-max points. Like, for instance, Chaos Warriors come to mind. Having a 10-man Chaos Warrior unit more than likely won't be standard anymore. You'll see people actually going for the 15 or the 20-man units, even in 1,000-point games, because it makes sense to do it for them. Plus, they have to be more survivable. The unit itself has to be more survivable.
That makes sense.
I don't think it makes faster because of that. You're going to see model counts probably go higher in lower-based games. But it makes it what it does, I think, is it allows everybody to play in every phase of the game.
I give you that.
Because now it's not, like Skaven and Night Goblins. They actually have stand some sort of a chance in close combat, and it's just not deliver the fanatics to the battlefield and then run in, and then hopefully you can stall the guy into the fanatics can smash into him. So you're going to see that's no longer a factor. They're actually kind of dangerous now.
Yeah. Everything's a lot more dangerous now.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the whole point. It's just a much bloodier battle. It's like everything's been ramped up. It's like this is like the final war as far as everybody on the, in the actual game world knows. I mean, you've got models dying faster, but units staying around longer. That just means that more models are going to die. You don't have a unit that's lost three guys running off the field. It's three guys left that are running off the field out of a unit of 40.
All right, let's move on to some of the new stuff here. So, the movement phase. A lot of that's kind of very similar, but the big change comes in charging. Whereas before, you charged twice your distance, now you charge your movement distance plus 2d6 inches. How do you think that's going to affect the gameplay a lot? Or blot a little?
It is going to affect it a lot. I've heard a lot of people complaining. They're more the hyper-competitive types. They think it puts a random element in that they don't like.
Well, it does put a random element in. There's no doubt about that.
Right. But, before, the random element was in your guessing. And, I was at a grand tournament where this guy had a pair of those shooter sunglasses on, and he made little etches in there, and you could see him trying to estimate distances like this. He was terrible at it, which is why he didn't get called on it for cheating, just because he sucks so bad. But that guess factor, a lot of people don't like it because before it was something they could use their people skills to overcome, the I know that is 8 inches kind of thing. But like we talked about before, there's also all kinds of other things. It's like, well, I can't march if I'm with 8 inches, so measure out, oh, look, that's 9.5. So now you already know that when you're trying to maneuver around. So there's, little things like that were maybe somewhat less than honest have disappeared because you got all the pre-measuring going on. But you've got a random element to your charge, so you got to figure that out.
Well, I think it's actually less random than actually guessing the range, the charge in the first place. So it's like saying in your head, I'm maybe 12 inches, but I'm going to go ahead and declare a charge anyways and hope for the best. Now you can pre-measure it and you say, well, I'm 10 inches away. The odds are on 2d6 mm-hmm. that you're going to roll what, between a 6 and an 8?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And if you know your movement's already 4, the odds are now increased. You actually so the randomness is switched. The odds are in your favor to charge something because you can pre-measure that distance and actually know if it's worth rolling a charge or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like it because it's taken the random factor and put it into the dice. I mean, instead of random guessing and like with the guess weapons and charge distances and everything, now it's the dice. Dice are random. That's what they are. They're randomization tools.
Yeah.
Now, do you think it also makes charging, or it's the opportunity to charge, a little more equal per se? And what I mean by that is, before, slow-moving armies like your dwarves, which moves normally 4 inches, would basically never get to charge. Because, a 6-inch guy walks up to him, charges 12 inches, gets smashed into your dwarves long before you could charge them.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Where now it's obviously a lot more equal because it's basically...
Well, again, all armies get to play somewhat equally in all phases of the game. Mm-hmm. Although I will say on the dwarves' behalf, I don't know what my fellow dwarf players will say, but I actually kind of don't like that for dwarves. This may be nostalgic or what have you, and it's just a personal thought, and it's not going to damage anything for me. But the fact that dwarves don't charge was what endeared me to them. It's the fact that I just hunker down in one corner of the table and you come to me was just something I really liked. And if there were the times that I took a highly mobile dwarf army, everyone was like, holy crap, they're moving across the table. Or to see a dwarf unit win combat and then all of a sudden overrun 12 inches across the board. Dwarfs on the move can be pretty dangerous, pretty deadly. So it'll be interesting to see what dwarfs actually being able to charge effectively, how much more dangerous that army will be.
They're supposed to be very dangerous over short distances.
Exactly. So there you go. Yeah. We're going to find out now, aren't we?
We're going to find out.
Absolutely.
Now, one of the other changes to charge that comes in the combat phase, we talked a little bit about this last time, was you no longer get first strike when you charge. You basically still go by initiative. Mm-hmm. How is that going to affect how you guys play your armies?
I'm going to like high elves a lot better.
Everyone likes high elves a lot better. And they were good before.
At first, I was worried about it because, the big thing about the orcs and goblins is, I got to get the charge off because otherwise I'm dead meat. But... now, I'm going to get my attacks back unless you slaughter my entire unit, basically. If I've got a unit of 20 boys, and they're in ranks of 5, you've got to kill 11 guys to cut back the number of attacks I'm going to get. You know, you're not likely to do that on the charge. I don't care whether you're, you know, all high elves, always striking first kind of thing, or whether you just have a high Anish. I still get the attacks back. So the charge is nice because it lets you dictate where the battle's happening on the field, but it's not as critical as to the amount of damage that's occurring.
Okay.
Yep.
Also, some of the other new things I think were in the movement phase. Moving sideways, where you actually shift your guys, is that new?
Not new in the slightest.
So,
no, okay.
They just reworded it.
Okay, that was in 7th edition flow?
And what's different, though, I think what you're feeling is different, is that in 6th and 7th edition, they had a variety of maneuvers you could perform. Nobody ever did that. Okay. Everybody, because, again, doing way too much math. A quarter of my move is how many inches, and I can do what? Everyone just did a reform.
Okay.
Because it's like, look, just screw it. I can't really can't move 2 inches. Is how far it doesn't really do anything. Mm-hmm. So I just do a reform and get what I wanted out of it. So kind of what GW has done, it's like, well, that's what everybody does now. So let's get rid of it. Case in point, if you didn't ever play 6th edition, and even if you did, you probably don't remember, you could actually put your army into a column, single file line. Now, why the hell would you want to do that? Because it took one turn to put them in that formation. Mm-hmm. Then you moved them, and another turn to put them back in your regular one.
That's half the game.
Yeah. So I could never figure out the point of doing that, but there it was. So that it's actually just more efficient.
Okay.
It is. Yeah, without a doubt.
So then the next phase, of course, in the turn is the magic phase. And there's some other big changes here, specifically how you generate power dice to cast spells into spells. Whereas before, based on the number of wizards you had and the level they were, you generated power dice. Now, in this edition, you roll 2d6, and that's how many power dice you get, and your opponent gets...
And the spell dice.
Yeah,
both opponent... people roll them. It's power and the spell.
Oh, yeah, no. The player's turn is rolls 2d6. That's how many power dice they get. Mm-hmm. And the highest die is how many the spell dice the opponent gets, correct?
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. And then, then you do the channeling, where both... Yeah, so you're talking about the channeling, then where you one for each wizard. If you get a 6, you get one more. What do you guys think about how this is going to change the magic phase?
You know, combining the way magic works with the fact that any level wizard can use 6 dice to cast a spell really kind of opens the floodgates on what wizards can do. They're supposed to be very capricious, very kind of haphazard to use, but highly effective at what they do. So by making the magic, the actual lores of magic, a ton more deadly, and coupling it with the fact that you can use a lot of dice to throw a spell even for a level 1 guy, I don't know, they've made them pretty dangerous.
Well, and I think that, again, going back to the comment, I think it should be the tagline for 8th edition, everyone plays in every phase of the game. You're no longer going to get a Zinch army that's got like 17, 18 spell dice, and the only thing you can generate is 6 to spell.
Right on.
It's an equalizer. So yeah, the Zinch heavy army is going to have some pretty powerful wizards. But he is not going to dominate singly the magic phase. He is going to face a fairly stiff opposition. Or he may get wiped out entirely and not have any magic to throw at all. So, I mean, I think it's a nice balance, a nice leveler. It doesn't make wizards any more or less dangerous. It's just level the playing field for all involved.
Now, do you think we're going to see less level 4 and level 3 wizards because of the fact that level 1 guys are so powerful? Or do you think it's still going to take them because they want
to level 7? I thought the same thing. In the first two games, I thought, damn, I can now just buy a whole bunch of level 1s and be happy with it. Yeah, not so much.
Not so much.
Because the level 2s and 3s and 4s, they bring some oomph. They bring some fire power to that thing.
Yeah. The extra bonus that you get to casting, values, and on a very basic level, actually knowing more than one spell is huge.
Yeah.
It's huge.
Yeah, the other thing that makes the magic less predictable is the miscast table. The miscast table, there's no friendly results there. So you start throwing a lot of dice, you know, those magic heavy armies that you just be able to throw dice and throw dice and throw dice.
Yeah.
A miscast now is liable to erase your wizard from the battle. Just like, poof, gone.
Or render them a non-wizard.
Yes,
or render them a non-wizard. Awesome. That felt good.
Yeah.
It happened to you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I had a great time, too.
He was so happy. My shadow wizard just stuck on his own.
So now,
on the top of the tower, no way to get down.
One of the changes to how magic works is Now, with the exception of the signature spell in each of the Lords of Magic, no two wizards in your army can have the same spell, correct?
That's true.
Yep. Do you think this is going to result in fewer wizards? Combine that with the fact that you no longer generate power dice per wizard, we're going to see like fewer wizards in an army?
I think you're going to see wizards that are using different lores.
Okay.
You'll see a bright wizard.
More diverse.
Basically. And then you'll see a lore metal.
Okay. That's rolling around. It's probably the same amount of wizards, just more diverse.
Yeah. And, well, and I think that, was one of the few times you do actually hits the tournament scene. I think that was one of them. Because if you go to a tournament, you'll see like multiples of the same wizard with lores just to get the one or two spells that are really worth it in the lore, because it's all randomized. Mm-hmm. And they think, you know, just guessing, I think that was just a move to say, all right, enough's enough. We want you to play with other lores that are out there.
Yep.
Right, and that's that mechanism there is also another way that they're moving away, so you don't get the hordes of level one wizards out there.
Yeah.
Because, mm-hmm. you know, you got if you get six level one wizards, you got one of every spell. And you know, and you're done. So what's the point of 10?
You know? Yeah.
That's what's the point of loading up on wizards? It's like, yeah, I'm going to take three level four wizards. You know, it's like, I mean, if you can scrape it out in the points, that's great, but it's not going to get you anything. You know,
unless you do different lores.
Unless you do different and then lores.
Some pretty cool stuff going down.
Right. You know, and then but for most things, you're not going to have those hordes all trying to do the same thing. You're not going to have half a dozen Comets of Cassandra floating on the table.
And, you know, and added again to that is the fact that you only got the 2d6 power dice to use to begin with.
Right.
So if you
right.
put six wizards out there, you're competing for resources at mm-hmm. a level that's just...
And you're better off putting the points into something
diminishing returns.
Yep.
You know, it's...
Now I've got a specific dwarf question for Jerry. I remember when I played your dwarf army, you have basically generate lots of the spell dice. The dwarves don't have any magic casters, but they have lots of the spell dice. Can they still generate additional spell dice on top of the random rolls in 8th edition too?
Okay. Because most of it's generated by the runes you take and other things factored in. So yeah, dwarves are going, I mean, I think they've become, I haven't played it yet in 8th edition, but I think they've become a serious anti-magic force within the game. I mean, they're going to probably, I mean, alright, so you go to the highest dice that someone can cast is 12, mm-hmm. which gives an opponent 6, maybe 7 or 8 if they get the wizard thing going on for themselves. Compare that to a dwarf, it's very easy for the dwarves with the 6 of that die roll to get 10 dispel dice.
Yeah.
So they're facing a dwarf army that's focusing himself on shutting down the magic phase, he's going to do it.
Okay. Let's talk then about the actual casting values. Obviously, the values need to roll to successfully cast a spell. They're higher in this edition. That also probably goes to the fact that you can roll more dice.
You have options in this edition.
That's true. Some of them have multiple casting values, don't they?
Yeah, right.
A lot of them do.
And now, I guess the reason this could potentially be an issue is, in the core rules now, of course, you've got the new casting value levels are all a little bit higher. Mm-hmm. But some of the old codexes, I know, like, for example, the Vampire Counts, my friend who plays Vampire Counts, they have the older spells that are, you know, kind of lower values, or even my Lizardman Codex, one of my, I think it's Lord Mondamuzi, pronounce the name right, has the City Breaker spell, which used to be the casting value was really high. Now it's kind of like average. So some of these more powerful spells that are codex specific are going to come in and be used more often and be cast easier. Think it's going to be a problem with the game at all, or will that just take time for all the codex to get refreshed?
I don't really think it'll be a problem at all because of the fact that a lot of those lores are just not better than the core ones. You know, the 8 lores that are in the rulebook are amazing. And while, you know, high magic is cool and it's got a couple of really cool things in there, you don't have the same versatility that you do out of the main ones.
I think that's always been true, though. I mean, it's very, very rare that, except maybe Chaos, because their lores are still very awesome compared to the basic book. But you're right, I think the I guess I'd say older books, maybe going back to mid-7th and later, you're going to see more choices coming out of the core. And that may be by design, because they may want... We'll actually see what happens with spells going forward out of the army books. If they become over the top, like they've always been in the past, if they become over the top from the base, then we'll know that their intent was that just escalate the baseline.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or to try to get you to flat towards the floor.
Well, look at the Skaven book. That was the last book that was in there, and it was designed with the new edition more or less in mind. And, yeah. Oh, no, Beastmen was out.
Well, you can't say that, because what's the FAQ of a Skaven army book? It's like 9 pages.
Sure.
It's like 3 times everybody else's.
Sure. But they put a lot of the kind of stuff that's in there. I mean, like the 25 level casting on the 13th spell. I mean, come on now. Come on, really? Who was going to be able to cast that?
Well, yeah, true. Yeah.
When did the Skaven book come out? When was that released?
It was in the fall, okay. winter of last year.
Okay, so yeah, by then they probably knew, you know, the basic guidelines of what they're doing with 8th edition, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. And again, one of the built-in checks to the higher levels is, you know, those more powerful spells start tossing more dice. Bigger chance of miscast, bigger chance of never ever casting another spell in your life.
And while we're talking on the idea of miscast, one of the changes in 8th edition was there no longer is a separate miscast and irresistible force. Where previously you could do irresistible force, basically you're guaranteed to cast your spell, it couldn't be dispelled, blah, blah, blah.
But nothing goes wrong.
Nothing goes wrong. And then also if you rolled terribly, you could get, you know, miscast and everything went wrong. Now they're combined into one thing. You get irresistible force, but apparently it also can cause your wizard's head to blow up.
Yep.
What do you think about that? Is that just...
I'm, you know, as an Orc and Goblin player, I've been dealing with that forever because we have our own WoG miscast table.
Oh,
you know, and it was like, you know, if I rolled a miscast and, you know, the top end of the WoG miscast was the spells cast irresistibly, roll again on this table.
So I guess I can tell everybody in fantasy, welcome to Orc and Morg.
Yes, yeah. It's just, it's deadlier. It's like you don't, there's nothing safe. The more dice you throw at something, the more likelihood that something's going to go boom. Hopefully, you're hoping that it's going to be your spell on your enemy, but there's no guarantees anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I just think it was a leveler to the magic phase.
And on the note of the magic phase, let me just put it out there for the world to hear. Poor Tomb Kings.
Yes.
Poor Tomb Kings.
What happened to them? Why did they get screwed?
Rest in peace. The way their magic phase works doesn't lend itself very well to
the new rules.
To the new rules, because everything is bound level spells.
Okay.
It's crazy.
Yeah, literally everything they have is a bound spell. Yeah. So,
and now you have to use
and
dice.
You have to use power dice to cast bound spells.
Yep.
So it's a little wonky.
It's like, do they have a new army book coming out soon?
Sure. Who knows? That all depends on, well, of course, sales, I'm sure. Yeah. Sales factor in there. But also I would have to say is how badly broken the army is to the intent of how it's supposed to play. Even if it's a little quirky and it's like, wow, this kind of sucks, if there are armies that suck worse, GM is not likely to do anything with them for a while.
Yeah.
Let's move on to the shooting phase. I guess before that, anything else about magic phase that we missed?
Well, I was just going to say, I guess, you know, if you really think about it, what it does is it dampens the effects of Tomb Kings. They're not as hot stuff on the table anymore. They're just kind of like, oh, well, welcome to the club.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, let's move on to the shooting phase then. One of the few changes to shooting, there weren't a lot to it, but true line of sight.
Wrong game.
This is something they did with 40K 5th edition, and now they've brought it into fantasy. I know I'm not a big fan of it. I've seen worse implementations than how Games Workshop does it, but do you think this is a good thing or bad thing for fantasy? Is it just make it more annoying, or
it is what it is.
Yeah, I don't like. Yeah. I'm not a fan of true line of sight, and I think I've said this when we did the 5th edition for 40K, and even in my own podcast. I'm not a fan of it, and this goes. I mean, from my experience, I don't think there's ever been a time when it's been in fantasy. I can't recall, anyways. Mm-hmm. 40K, it's always been there until 4th edition, and I think up to 4th edition and. Folks that didn't play 40K previously do not understand the level of pain that comes with years and years of dealing with true line of sight. I mean, it can get pretty anal retentive about what you can and can't see. And there's an evolution to it where everyone's all happy-go-lucky. It's like, oh, can I see it or can I not? Yeah, I'll give it to you. You can see it. Well, then that'll quickly interpret that if the model's arm is sticking up over the hill, it's like, I can see him. I'm going to shoot him. Why, no. Well, true line of sight says this. Mm-hmm. You got to apply some flippant common sense to it. That's all I can say. I mean, if the model is frozen in a pose where the horse is rearing up, the guy's standing up on a charge, and he's a good 3 inches taller than everybody else, come on now. You know? I mean...
They actually put it into the rules that you're not supposed to count things like the weapons and the banners and stuff like that. It's supposed to be like their torso being visible. But you know, on the other hand, I'll play a little little opposite here. I got tired of the 30-minute pregame discussion on exactly what each terrain piece was and did. It's like, it's a hill. Yes, does it block line of sight? Is it difficult terrain? Does it block line of sight for large models? It's like, it's a hill! You know, I run up it, I run down it. I run up it, I run down it. Grass grows on the side.
On top.
You know, Jack and Jill went up it. Why is it an issue for you? You know, yeah, you know, it's, you know, it was just a big problem.
Wow. It's come to that.
It's happened.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, I got tired of that, all those little discussions. True line of sight has its issues, but one of them is not overly complex.
But I think that's
it's a simple thing.
But that's six of one, half dozen to the other. I mean, now the discussion, instead of analyzing each big blob of terrain on the board, because, you know, quite honestly, you can have one tree there and say, yeah, that the whole 5 inches around is a big, thick grove of trees, blocks line of sight, and you go, okay, got it. Well, now you quite literally have to have the trees there.
Yeah.
But you're going to get into a discussion. It's like, can I see it or can I not? No, you can't see it. Well, I beg to differ. I can see them or can I not? The argument has just shifted a different way. And I think it's shifted to the negative because those are judgment, subjective calls by each of the players. Previously, if the blob of terrain there blocks line of sight and it's difficult terrain, it is what it is. Regardless, if you guys agreed to it, that's it is what it is. Yes, the pre-game checklist was much bigger. I think true line of sight made the inter-during game checklist much more complicated.
Mm-hmm. But I just think that those little quirks are likely to come up less often than let's examine it from the very beginning of the game.
You're probably
every possible
right.
situation.
You're probably right because, again, this is the first time this has been introduced to fantasy.
Right,
40K,
right.
True line of sight, and I'm telling you, 5th edition's only been out, what, a year and a half?
Yeah, about that.
2008.
I'm telling you, if they haven't done another update in the 4-year time cycle that they have been, it's going to be a big argument deal for 40K.
See, I think True Line of Sight is a good fit in 40K. The thematic element of it.
Absolutely. But the anal retentive individuals can't get that, can't leave.
Sure, but those are the same people that I would never want to play a game against anyway.
Exactly.
Well, you have a couple of them.
Yeah, do I play against them?
I have no idea.
I just
appreciated that the true line of sight argument not in 40K anymore, and being able to say a building acts like X, and being able to say that's a building.
Sure, mm-hmm. And you can still do that. I mean, you can if you and your opponent agree, you can do whatever you want.
Well, yeah, well, true. I mean, that's,
you know,
ultimately, yeah.
Yeah,
so
I mean, there's
nothing
to stop you from saying, here's a forest. Yes, we're going to move some of the trees out of the forest in order for units to get in there, but everything around that border, it blocks line of sight.
No, true. It's
nothing
to say I can't anything. Run away with his army if I lose either.
But you know, the
rules
trees...
don't say I can't punch you in the face.
Like even the Games Workshop terrain, the trees themselves, all right, that's a pretty open area.
Yep.
You can see one straight through the other side.
And like I said, I didn't really come out and say the argument when I was talking to Brent. The benefit of true line of sight is you quite literally have to have the terrain on the board. You can't just throw down one of these like bases like this and say, yeah, I know what it looks like, but it's actually a grove of heavily dense forest.
Mm-hmm.
No, there quite literally has to be trees on the table now. That's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because they can't put a piece of paper there and say, oh, this is pine.
Or felt.
Yeah, or felt.
Yes. Oh, God, I love felt.
I've got a felt board at home.
It's been years.
I've got a little battle board and I've got a felt board.
All right.
I'm on both ends.
All right, we've had enough of true line of sight. One of the other few changes was now you can fire in multiple ranks. I think the first two ranks can now fire.
Thank God.
That just kind of goes along with the whole kill more stuff.
Who hasn't seen a war movie where first rank fire, second rank fire went down?
I'm just waiting for it when the third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth can shoot.
I want to fire.
But they've got volley fire. They've got volley fire.
Doesn't the rings have
volley
fire?
Yeah. Everybody has volley fire now.
Oh, do they?
Yeah.
With
what
bows.
It is
bows.
With bows.
Okay,
but
well,
yeah, with your bows, everybody
crossbows
after the third rank,
if you
choose to volley fire, which you can't do when you move, every rank after the first two, you get half the number back there. So if you got a block of 20, five by four, you got 10 there, five.
I
just finished
reading the book. Yeah.
30 attacks, 30 bow shots.
Is there any?
I think 300.
Yeah.
Is there any negative?
That is awesome.
Negative ballistic skill?
No.
Nope. You just can't do it. Can't do it when you move. Can't do it on stand and shoot.
Yeah, you can't volley on the
field. Damn.
Yeah.
I, Goblin archers are in my army.
Goblin archers. They've been there.
Holy crap.
They've been there, but now I don't.
Now
I've got to
find a bunch of battle skull past archers.
I've got my 80. You're out of luck.
Can't you just imagine a new Empire book where it had fire by rank?
Can't
you just see him take a knee and taking a knee, next rank. You know, I can see it. I see it. The thematic, it's there.
So the volley fire is only for normal bows and arrows.
But you know, I don't remember it being restricted to just bows.
I assume you can't use obviously like muskets or something. That doesn't make any sense.
But why doesn't it? Civil War?
Yeah. Volley fire, page 78.
I don't even think it's crossbows. I think it's just...
Those are slow to shoot weapons. I mean, there's actually different classifications of the weapon.
Well, okay. What else would be able to volley fire? I mean,
it does not define. A unit has to have the special rule.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. All right.
All right.
All you have to do is look at the weapons and see if they do volley fire.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it says bows and other weapons can lose their projectiles in high arc volley. So if handgunners get that special rule, good to go.
I like it.
Hilarious. Okay.
Just two little words. Pulls it all together. All
right.
Yeah.
So let's move on to a few last quick topics. The standard scenarios. Now, I guess if you want to call a standard game, you roll a D6 and see which one of the six normal standard scenarios you play. Awesome?
Hell yes.
Absolutely.
Yep. Just changes things up more, makes things more variety.
Those missions are so fun.
Yeah, they are fun. I mean, this is not a hit on them in either way. But I will say that I do think that players are, when they want to have a throwdown game, will probably end up playing nothing but a pitched battle. Anyway.
Bah!
With the terrain rules. Yeah. I mean, just long experience with it. I'm now with a group of guys that love to play the fun stuff. So, but the vast majority of hobbyists don't play in a store. They play with the four other buddies in the basement once or twice a week. And they will probably, if they already haven't dedicated themselves to actually trying a bunch of new stuff, will probably just generally have a throwdown pitch battle.
Do you do that with 40K?
Sometimes, yes.
Really?
Yes.
I never do that.
Well, think about it. I mean, we're in different areas of our life, right? So every hobbyist is. For me, time is important. So for me to show up to the store or even on the hobby night, I want to get the game rolling. So if everything hasn't been predetermined up front, like I haven't called a buddy of mine, I'll give it a good friend of mine, Jeff. If I haven't set up for the days before I'm going to show up to his house and play, set up what scenario we're going to play, the terrain, and he hasn't already set up, chances are me and him are just going to have a standard meat grinder mission. Because we don't have time to deal with all that other stuff. So if I'm not sitting down for the evening for a good 5-hour session, I'm probably going to play a stand-up. And that isn't an indictment to anything other than my life, unfortunately, does not revolve around the hobby.
Even when I'm playing brand new players, which does happen on occasion, I still say, okay, roll for mission, setup.
But again, you have more time to be able to allot.
I've got a lot on my plate, sir. I don't have kids at home, but I got a lot on my plate.
I didn't say that. I mean, you just have a lot more flexibility with your time.
In the evenings,
I have absolutely zero.
See, I'd rather go with the quality of the game than faster speed to try and get it done. I'd rather play through one game in a week that takes 5 hours than two and a half hour games.
And that just comes down to, can you have that 5-hour block of time available?
Right. I mean, it's a personal thing. Mm-hmm. I just think that the vast majority of people are probably going to play a pitched battle. And that isn't an indictment. I mean, that's why I think they did that in 7th edition. They just played homage to the fact that everybody played it. But then, frankly, the missions in 6th and 7th are pretty messed up. Anyways.
Yeah, which is maybe why, you know, some of us are really pushing toward the new scenarios, because we're so tired of pitch battle.
I'm so sick of pitch battle.
Absolutely.
And pitch battle lended itself to the pool table. It's like, okay, everybody lines up on my side. I line up on my side. 8-ball, go in the pocket.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
But, I will say, the game that you played against Brent a few weeks ago, the scenario screwed you.
Oh yeah.
So, and I know for a fact a lot of people don't like that. So you will see, generally speaking, not anybody we know. Generally speaking, most people will probably avoid that mission because they don't like to lose the game before you even.
Which mission was that?
It was the one where everyone wakes up in the middle of the night under attack.
Okay, yeah.
And they have to stumble to the battlefield. You never know where they're going to end up.
Was it Dawn Patrol?
Basically ran an appointment.
Right. Yeah. It was great. My general was on the opposite side from all that. That's what he gets for setting up camp. And he's not near his troops.
It's fun. It's fun, but when, again, most people aren't going to want to lose the game. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you know, to be fair, it wasn't the scenario that killed you. It wasn't the scenario that killed you. It was the dice rolls regarding that scenario. I mean, it could have ended up that we would have had 2/3 of our troop waiting to come on in.
Right.
I mean, so it's not the fact that the scenario did that. It's just bad dice rolls.
Oh, we're thinking of a different game. I was thinking of the one that was memorable. Not the one where we had the team game that just ended in total slaughter.
That
team game was...
I didn't even count that team game. I didn't play fantasy that night.
The scenario screwed you guys. That's the one I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. One screwed you.
I just set up my guys backwards so I could just...
I think it was the Dawn Patrol. Okay.
I just set up in reverse so that you could just automatically rear charge all my units.
Me and Brent versus John. That was it. 3 or 4 turns before his partner showed up to the battle.
Savage.
Yep.
Okay. Well, just about done here. So one more quick topic I want to talk about is the alliances. They actually kind of have rules how you can have different races fight together on one side, which is actually a really cool thing, I think, because a lot of times players show up want to play a team battle with just random races. You don't really know how well those different races interact with each other. You guys like that?
As a all the time thing. Very, very unbalancing. If you have one side that is a loyal alliance where everyone's trusted, all right, and then the other side isn't trusted, all right, that side will probably lose.
Are you speaking about a very specific game?
No, I'm not. I've never even played with those rules, but I've seen them play with those rules.
The Great Lakes Crossing for the opening. 8th edition.
We didn't use those rules that
night.
Because we had Skaven on both sides. So it was going to be a nightmare. We had all trusted allies, and then my Skaven somehow got in amongst all these elves and everything like that. So I just ruined everything. Ruined it all. So they just said, you know what, maybe not. Maybe this is a bad idea.
I like it. Just for balancing the weirdness, but I'll agree. It's not the competitive type of rule.
Sure.
But I never like the high elves and dark elves against vampire counts. It's like what? No, it's just play no.
How about high elves and dark elves versus high elves? There we go.
Anything silly like that.
Well, sometimes those kind of alliances just lend themselves because 4 guys want to play and they all have different armies.
Yeah.
Right. Well, now there's rules that say, we can't just make it random. Let's try and figure out order versus chaos, good versus evil kind of thing.
I think rules like that are always kind of superfluous because if it's 4 guys and they play between themselves very often, they want to have a 4x4 game, but don't really want to have to buy like another army in order to do it, they're going to ignore that rule.
Right.
I'm not saying it's a bad rule, I'm just saying it's good to have for guys like us to have multiple armies that maybe want to create a special scenario, like for instance, the kin war between the High Elves and the Dark Elves, and you want to throw another army into the mix.
Mm-hmm.
Now you can add some other thing because the Elves, either side, don't trust anyone. So they're not likely to have vampire counts help them out. Mm-hmm. If they are, there's going to be a detriment to it. You can add flavor to the game and so forth. So.
Right. It adds more flavor, but like anything that adds flavor, it has the potential to throw off the competitive balance.
As long as they start even with each other, it's fine. It's balanced. Yeah.
Well, you're certainly not going to see the most powerful army on one side and the most powerful on the other side play together effectively.
Yeah.
Like chaos and high elves. You're not going to see a mix like that.
No.
Without someone screaming at you and said, you guys have problems with your alliance.
You need to get out of here.
Yeah.
Right. Which, I like. And I never liked people cherry picking the best kind of alliances, just to screw up big battles and stuff like that. Not that I've ever been a big fan of the mega battles anyway.
And I really go back to our campaigns as well. I go back to whenever we do it, we always had an ally chart in there. And it wasn't, you can ally, but you have these problems is either or, you can or you can't.
Right.
And that's far more effective. It's far more closer to the truth. But if you want to do it if we ever do a campaign again, we can throw that chart in there and say, well, do it, show and risk.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which makes sense. Yeah. You know, it's not for the, hi, we're going to fight the rest of our existence as these weird allies. It's like, okay, we kind of have a common enemy this battle, and that's going to make some issues. You know, 3 days from now, we're enemies again. But right now, those guys over there are a bigger threat.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that's the kind of thing that I think the rules are supposed to represent. And I like that.
Yep. Right. Sounds good. Well, we're just about done here, so... Let me thank you guys all for coming on the show. Great discussion. It's good to hear some different opinions.
Right.
And so,
even if they're inferior to mine. Yeah.
Just gotta deal with it every now and then.
Wow. Dude, you're the one with the shake weight microphone over here.
We're arguing over there. Questions or comments, you can send them over to me at jason@rockosoftware.com. That's rockosoftware.com. Twitter at tg_battlefield. Steam for Rock Robotics for Steam and StarCraft 2. I think if you search by my email, jason@rockosoftware.com, I think you can find me.
Aren't you online?
And not for Twitter.
I still don't know how the friends thing work in StarCraft 2 yet, so we'll figure it out. That's why I haven't actually played any multiplayer StarCraft 2 yet.
Oh,
so.
Fail.
Yeah, fail.
So you guys need better than the Koreans?
No. Are you kidding me?
Did you hear... Off topic, have you heard the clicks per minute you have to do in order to compete with them?
It's something like 300?
Yeah, 300 clicks per minute you have to do in order to compete.
Their units practically vibrate with energy. You look at them.
Through the internet?
They vibrate. Because there's so much clicking going on around them that they're always just...
They train their mouse hand with shake weights.
Now on
my
DVD.
My editor story is to you.
I'm sure Jerry wants to pimp his show, so...
I'm Jerry. You can get me on Twitter at MyGeekyLife. And I've also started a podcast for the 40K Fight Club called Fight Night. You can find it on iTunes.
Awesome. Well, once again, thanks for watching. We'll see you guys again in about 2 weeks on the next episode of the Tabletop Battlefield.